Hello and welcome to a new episode in New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. In each new program, we choose an important new book in the larger field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. Today we will be talking with Professor Ahmad Ashamsi, Assistant Professor of Islamic Studies at the University of Chicago, and about his new book, The Canonization of Islamic Law, A Social and Intellectual History. In this brilliant book, Professor Ashamsi explores the question of how the discursive tradition of Islamic law was canonized during the 8th and 9th centuries CE, while focusing on the religious thought of the towering Muslim jurist Muhammad bin Idris al-Shafi'i and the intellectual and social milieu in which he wrote. Professor Ashamsi presents a fascinating narrative of the transformation of the Muslim legal tradition in early Islam. He convincingly argues that through al-Shafi'i's intervention, a previously mimetic model of Islamic law, inseparable from communal practice, made way for a more systematic hermeneutical enterprise enshrined in a clearly defined scriptural canon. Through a rich and multi-layered analysis, Professor Ashamsi shiningly demonstrates how and why this process of canonization came about. Written in a remarkably lucid and accessible fashion, this groundbreaking study will delight and benefit specialists and non-specialists alike. In our conversation, we talked about the shift from oral to written culture in early Islam, the contrast between the normative projects of Malik and al-Shafi'i, al-Shafi'i's theory of language, the social and political reasons for the success of his legal theory, and the transmission of al-Shafi'i's thought by his students. Here now is my conversation with Professor Ahmad Ashamsi. Hello and welcome to a new episode in New Books in Islamic Studies. In each episode, we choose a new book which is a major intervention in the field of Islamic studies and we chat with its author. Today, I have the pleasure and privilege of talking to Professor Ahmad Ashamsi, who is an assistant professor of Islamic studies at the University of Chicago in the Department of Near Eastern Studies, and his new book, The Canonization of Islamic Law, A Social and Intellectual History, published by Cambridge University Press in 2013. Hello, Ahmad. How are you doing?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your time, Ahmad. And as I was saying before we went live, this is just a splendid and wonderfully written book and a really multi-layered analysis of a host of issues and themes that we will have a chance to discuss in a moment. But before we get to the substance of the book, we like to begin our conversations by asking the authors about their the story of their intellectual lives, how you came into the study of Islam and came to write this book. If you could tell our listeners something about your background and the story of how you became interested in Islamic studies and this particular topic.
I went to college and I majored in politics and Arabic. So I read Arabic literature, classical, but primarily modern. I was primarily interested in the modern period. But for my paper, my BA paper, I looked at modern discussions of the Napoleon's conquest of Egypt, and there were a lot of themes, classical themes, that came up and that, frankly, I just didn't know how to handle.
Right.
And so I started to dip into the classical sources. And on the one hand, it was interesting, but on the other hand, it was kind of strange to me. And then after finishing college, I spent a year in Egypt and I found a teacher to read a work on Islamic law with him, and that was a very intense experience. We read this book from cover to cover. It was 2-volume work, and afterwards I really felt ready to tackle classical texts, and I spent many hours in bookshops in Egypt and just familiarizing myself with all these strange and fascinating topics. And even though I afterwards did a master's in international relations, but really my interest had kind of shifted to the pre-modern period. And I then started my PhD at Harvard, and you know, there were things I was reading in secondary sources that there were things I was looking for in secondary sources that I kind of didn't find. So in a sense, my research and my PhD research and now what has become my book is in a sense trying to write the kind of book that I would have liked to have, you know, mm-hmm. 15 years ago or something like this. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. So let us begin the conversation by discussing the title of the book, which is The Canonization of Islamic Law, A Social and Intellectual History. So if I could have you say something about this term canonization, which comes up in your title, then there's a very interesting and specific way in which you employ and mobilize this category, the idea of canonization in early Islam. Could you say a little more about how you use this term in your book, canonization?
Yeah, at the outset, I have to say I'm generally not a friend of big theoretical terms or discussions, and I'm kind of I don't actually use the term very much in the book, but I think it gives the book its structure, mm-hmm. And that is something that that I've learned a lot from reading outside of the field of Islamic studies, which is the phenomenon of texts changing significance historically because of changing social, political, and cultural historical circumstances. So that it is not just that a text is somehow there and there's only one way of using it and of this text finding its place within society, but the different historical circumstances might shift the relevant usage and the authority of a text. Mm-hmm. And so the point that I'm trying to make with this title is that I argue that there is a point in the development of Islamic law when it becomes canonized, when there is a very specific way in which authority is transferred from the community as an interpretive community to a group of scholars who are explaining and interpreting texts. And the shift happens because there is a kind of a growing kind of suspicion regarding the communal practice and the wisdom of the communal practice, the communal tradition, the continuity of this tradition, and that particularly Shafi'i, as a theorist, as a legal theorist who writes the first book on legal theory, is somebody who lays out a theory of revelation that says we don't really need communal practice. Revelation as texts, as the Quran and as the texts of the prophetic statements, is self-explanatory. So we do not need to see these sources within a context of communal practice. This communal practice sometimes distorts these sources. Rather, these sources and the proper understanding of language and the proper deployment of hermeneutic techniques will yield a much, much clearer and a much more consistent law than the kind of communal legal traditions that he found when he was when he began his journey.
Now, one of the most fascinating shifts that you talk about very early on in your book, and you convincingly argue, is this shift from an oral tradition to a written culture, and this culture of literacy that you talk about, that in many ways was exemplified by Malik's Muwatta. Could you explain a bit more the significance of this culture of literacy, this shift from an oral to a written culture, to the intellectual history of Islamic law in early Islam and the place of Malik's Muwatta within that narrative?
Yeah, I mean, this is something that has struck me. You know, when I came into Islamic studies, some of the most interesting and thought-provoking studies that I encountered early on, works by Gregor Schöler, for example, on different types of orality and writing. But really that nobody had taken that forward and to ask, well, okay, so we have the emergence of Islamic literature sometime in the second century, in the second Islamic century. What's the influence of this shift on the actual thought? I mean, it's not just, we don't really have books before that, so, you know, we don't know whether they are authentic or not. It's not just an authenticity problem, but it's also, you know, it's not the same thing. To have a scholarly discourse in the oral realm is a very different thing than to have a written scholarly discourse. And what does it, first of all, what could be the motivation of having this this shift? And secondly, what is the simple kind of mechanical, or I mean, what is the result, the effect of this shift on the very content of this thought and the logic of development that follows afterwards? What struck me about Malik's Muwatta is that it seems, and this is something that I'm that from other pieces of evidence is quite clear to me, is that that by writing this work, Malik was aiming at cementing a communal tradition or preserving a communal tradition that was on the verge of change or of being lost. And what is so interesting is that on the one hand, you know, we think about Malikism as the doctrine of Medina, but really after Malik, the center of Malikism is not Medina anymore. It leaves Medina. So by writing a book, you can basically turn a local legal tradition mobile and set it loose from the actual locality in which it was produced, and it can thrive in other places. So there is this strangely paradox process where on the one hand you write a book to preserve a local tradition, but by doing this you kind of make it movable. You allow it to actually leave that locality and settle in Spain or in North Africa or in Egypt or in Iraq. That is one importance. And the other importance is that with the coming of written works, you have a different logic of scholarly involvement with each other. You don't anymore have these oral exchanges. They still exist, they still happen. But you have a different kind of exchange, which is these written refutations that can happen over space and time. So, you know, you can write a refutation of Malik from Iraq, and then somebody else can reply to this. What I'm trying to show in the book is that in your written engagement with a different scholar, you use a totally different type of argumentation than in a potential oral debate. And so I think the development of higher hermeneutic thought is part and parcel of bringing scholarly discussions from an oral into a written realm.
Terrific. Now, one of the key themes that dominates much of your book, especially the early chapters, is this really interesting and fascinating relationship between Ash-Shafi'i and Malik, and the contrasting understandings of tradition and law, which centered on these two figures. So could you tell us something about Ash-Shafi'i's evolution that you discuss, a very fascinating evolution from being one of Malik's disciples to arguably his most formidable critic?
So I think it's the real backbone of my study is a close reading of Ash-Shafi'i's Kitab al-Umm that we have today in a critical edition of 10 volumes. And I think if you read this book carefully, and the interesting thing about it, it's not a single book that was authored at a specific point, but it's really Ash-Shafi'i's work from throughout his lifetime are brought together within this work. And you can see different layers of his interaction, and you can see what is so remarkable is that Shafi has actually recorded his debates, and he said, you know, he's explicit about it. He tells you when he is when he's debating the Iraqis, when he's debating Shaybani, Abu Hanifa student Shaybani. So we can see the early, and these are the early texts, the most early layers of text that we find in his work. So we can see him as a student of Malik going to Iraq and engaging these Hanafi scholars in debate. And we can see that at the beginning he is still very much a scholar in the mold of Malik. He still argues on the basis of either Medinan practice or the practice of the people of Hijaz. But it's also interesting to see how he encounters more systematic legal thought, more and kind of principles of interpretation. For example, within this debate with the Shaybani, with Abu Hanifa student Shaybani, he encounters a specific theorization of hadith, namely hadith as a kind of secondary hermeneutic tool towards the Quran. So the hadith, as the Shaybani puts it there, is what clarifies the divine intention in the Quran. So this kind of hermeneutic principle we do not find in Malik's thought. So we find Ash-Shafi encountering these ideas among the Hanafis in Iraq, and Ash-Shafi is taking these ideas and he uses them to critique the Iraqis as well. So he is somebody who takes his Medinan background, his experiences in Iraq, who critiques the Iraqis for their own shortcomings and for failing to live up to their own principles. Mm-hmm. And he is very very much in contact with the people of Hadith, Ahmed ibn Hanbal and his crew in Iraq. Mm-hmm. And he becomes convinced of the kind of scientific nature of this project of massive hadith collections, etc., etc. And he he develops a legal approach that is not reliant anymore on local traditions. Mm-hmm. And so what I argue is that both the Hijazi, the Medinan and the Meccan legal traditions, and the Iraqi traditions, the Kufan tradition, these are legal traditions that see revelation through the lens of local practice. So they would accept a hadith as long as it has been accepted within that legal tradition. If it's from the outside, if it's from, you know, if somebody walks into Kufa or walks into Baghdad from, let's say, Transoxiana with a hadith, that would have no impact on them because it is not, as the Iraqis would say, it's not mashhur, it's not known among us. So it has no authority. This does not mean, and I think this is the point where I disagree so strongly with Josef Schacht. This does not mean that these legal schools didn't have hadith. That is not the point of these discussions. I think this is a fundamental misreading of these discussions. It's not about that these legal schools existed without hadith and that Shafi somehow imposes that on them. They had their own hadith, but they only used the hadith that were embedded in their local tradition. And Ash-Shafi said there is formally no difference between these hadith and other hadith as long as the chain of narration, the isnad, is sound. So he is de-regionalization. He's universalizing hadith builds up a system within which you do not need local tradition to figure out what the law is.
Now, with your permission, Ahmed, I want to spend a bit more time actually on this comparison between Malik and Ash-Shafi, because it's such a productive aspect of your book. Could you say a bit more about the competing imaginaries of Muslim normativity or tradition, which you see being articulated by Ash-Shafi and Malik and their projects of Islamic law? And, for example, at one moment in your book, you very beautifully contrast these two models, and you write, the essentially communal activity of mimesis gave way to the individual task of hermeneutics. This comes on page 71 of Ahmad al-Shamsi's book, The Canonization of Islamic Law. What is this contrast between a mimetic versus a hermeneutic understanding of law? And what are sort of the larger philosophical underpinnings of these two projects of how law, revelation, and tradition are being imagined by Malik and Ash-Shafi?
Well, this is, I remember very early in my in grad school, I met an anthropologist who had spent some time in Afghanistan in the 70s, and he told me an interesting anecdote about a villager he had talked about Islam. And the villager had argued that in Islam you can basically have whatever up to 8 wives. I think he said that, and this American non-Muslim anthropologist said, well, no, it's 4 is the maximum. And the villager says, no, you don't know what you're talking about. And eventually they had gone to some mullah to ask him, and the mullah said, of course, it's the maximum is 4 wives. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards the villager still was not convinced. Uh-huh. And he said, why, what's your argument? And the villager said, well, we in my village, we are Muslims, and there's the one head man, and he has 8 wives. Uh-huh. So that's it. I don't need, some mullah. He doesn't have to give me some evidence. Right. Right. So we have, we as a community are Muslims, and that's what happens in our village. So that's what is true. And, at the time I was thinking, this is just some sort of, whatever, some cute anecdote. What's the relevance of this? It just right. shows a kind of level of lack of education or something. But then if you think about it historically, a community that has prophecy among them, a community that has grown in a place. And here I think it's important to show the difference between Islam and Christianity and Judaism, that in Christianity and Judaism you have these raptures. Judaism has Babylonian captivity. Christianity has centuries of being an underground religion. But you have an actual continuity. You have under Muhammad, Medina becomes autonomous and maintains. Under Malik's time, it's still autonomous. There's a clear continuity, a political continuity, a communal continuity. Law has a It has a precedent about itself. So what I call mimetic law, as a mimetic quality, is something. If you have this continuity in a community, that law itself is this, is its own justification. We've done it like this before. It was founded like this from the Prophet and his companions. So it's authentic. It is not a hermeneutic exercise in the sense of, oh, we have to sit down and look for the verse where it says this, but rather there is a wider sense of communal authenticity that makes a connection between the law and religion. Not in the sense that, oh, well, they didn't care about the Quran or about the Sunnah, but there's a feeling about it, about there is, there's things in society, and we know this about Malik. I mean, there's things like the call to prayer, where he says, well, I'm not interested what your evidence is. We've had this call for prayer since the Prophet's time. That's itself a proof. But the issue with the Shafi'i is that Shafi'i was also a very historical mind. And his break with Malik is basically his realization that tradition changes and that tradition does not stay the same. And what do we do? What is the way in which we can maintain authenticity, maintain a relationship to revelation? And his solution is to say, well, actually, revelation itself is giving us the clues. We actually do not need communal tradition. Communal tradition, especially now, he says this explicitly in some discussion. Where he says, we have generation, we have four, five, six generations between us and the Prophet now. What do we do? We have to come to terms with this. We cannot think anymore that there is this unchanging tradition that connects us to those times, because we know that that positions have changed, and he gives examples how positions have changed over time. So he says, simply saying that this is our authenticity and our connection to revelation is guaranteed by tradition, that doesn't work anymore. Simply by the fact that time has passed and that the tradition has changed. So there is a, and that's what I mean with canonization. There is a removal of law from community towards the interpretation of texts. And who are the people who interpret texts? They are jurists. So there is a new. So there, on the one hand, there's hermeneutics, and the people who carry this out are scholars. I'm not saying that there were no scholars before that, but the kind of scholarship they were involved in is now a different kind of scholarship.
Ashafi clearly is the major protagonist of your book, but one of the things that you do wonderfully well is connecting Ashafi's thought with the larger intellectual and social milieu in which he was operating, and showing ways in which he developed his own thought in conversation with his intellectual opponents, often through debate with Malikis and Hanafis and so forth. And you've already touched on this a few minutes ago, but if I could have you elaborate further on how did Ashafi's legal thought mature through his debates with his intellectual antagonists, such as the Hanafis. What do we know about those debates, and how did they impact the maturation of Ashafi's legal thought?
So there is, in my book, I talk about three main strands with whom Ashafi interacts. On the one hand, there is his first polemical engagement is with Hanafis in Iraq. Then when he goes to Egypt, he starts to criticize his original teacher Malik, but there is also already a polemical engagement with a specific kind of Mu'tazili theological strand, particularly prominent among them, a scholar called Ibn Ulayya. This is a scholar who rejects all hadith. And I think this is a very crucial point, and it might actually have been the initial motivation for Shafi to write on legal theory. This encounter with the theologian who rejected hadith in toto. I think one of the issues is one of the central issues is the question of what sunnah is. What is this normative practice that is not from the Quran, but that is that we have to emulate. One of the interesting polemical engagements that we see in Shafi's writing today is that it was the Hanafis who, for the first time, who criticized Malik and saying, well, he says something as sunnah, but this could be hadith or it could be non-hadith. So just the practice of Medina for him is, can also establish a kind of sunnah, and so he's not clear in that. At first, Shafi'i actually defended Malik and said, no, anything that was that the Medinans believed to be sunnah goes back to the Prophet. And then, you know, the next paragraph, clearly Shafi'i added later on in his life, and he said, look, I've changed my mind. And now I'm convinced that that's actually true. The Medinans do sometimes call something sunnah where there's no hadith, where there's nothing that we can trace back to Muhammad. So sunnah is only hadith. And this, you know, I mean, I think that this is something that already earlier historians have pointed out, that something that Shafi'i pushes in his legal theory. There's also a critique of the Hanafis, where Shafi'i says, well, you yourself are not consistent here. You sometimes use hadith and sometimes you do not use the hadith. So you have to consistently use any hadith whose chain of transmission is reliable. So his primary critique of Hanafis is the use of weak hadith or the disregard of hadith. These polemical engagements and his cosmopolitanism, the fact that he begins his intellectual life in the Hejaz, he has crucial encounters in Iraq, and then he ends his life in Egypt, really show him as somebody who seeks to transcend local, regional legal traditions and develop something that can transcend these legal these regional traditions. And what you mentioned about the kind of the subtitle of the book, A Social Intellectual History, is that I think you can only really understand this as part and parcel of much wider social developments in the Muslim world, namely that this regional model of law just doesn't do it anymore. We have I have two chapters where I go into quite some detail about Egypt. And what I'm trying to show here is that that we can see this these social changes in detail. If we look at the details of Egypt as a case study, where you have this original society of Muslims, this small, close-knit Arab society that has a very strong sense of tradition, of, you know, I give an example about how the communal prayer is set up in the central mosque in Fustat in Egypt, and the people have a very strong sense of that is how we've always done it here. So there's a strong sense of local legal tradition. But with time, you can see that, you know, you have foreigners come in and you have non-Muslims converting to Islam. They feel much less allegiance to some sort of tradition, communal tradition. They've converted to Islam. They are much more open to listen to the argument about the Quran, about what the Prophet said, rather than some local tradition that is established within a specific close-knit, ethnically harmonious community, to listen to a much more systematic legal theory that and here Shafi'i's theory of language comes in, where basically all you really need to know is need to know the Arabic language properly. So that is a shift away from communal practice to a more hermeneutic understanding of revelation as basically texts.
So building on the comment that you just made, I mean, one of the central arguments that you make very convincingly in this book is that Shafi's hermeneutic, central to this hermeneutics, was his conception of language. So if you could continue this thought, how was Ashafi's conception of language connected to how he understood law and revelation? What is the theory of language that you so wonderfully detail and theorize in your book?
So, the basic thought that that Ashafi has about revelation is that it's there to express the intention of the speaker, and that's the idea of bayan. And that's very much derived from a reading of the Quran itself. Quran, kitab mubin, Quran mubin, kitab mubin, liyubayyin, to clarify that the Quran speaks about itself as clear, as clarifying, but at the same time it also speaks about language as a tool for expressing clearly yourself clearly. Allamahul bayan. That says Surah Ar-Rahman, God has taught human beings to express themselves clearly. Ashafi's legal theory is basically setting out how revelation does that, how it expresses itself clearly, what the techniques are inherent in the Arabic language, so that you can understand what it says. So in many respects, this is something about learning the conventions of the language, and saying that revelation happens within ordinary language. I mean, it's particularly elegant, it's particularly clear, but at the end of the day, you know, us knowing the rules of Arabic, I'm not saying just the grammatical rules, but the way within which meaning is conveyed in Arabic, that is basically what is needed to understand revelation. You do not need an infallible imam. You do not need to know how earlier community, you know, earlier generations of people have understood this. You basically, you know, at the heart of it, you only need to understand revelation itself, the texts, the statements of revelation itself. And I think in that extent, that is really new. That is really novel. And this attention to Arabic, that's something that has puzzled people in Ashafi's writing. Mm-hmm. Some people have accused Ashafi of, you know, what is this, some sort of shu'ubiya, some sort of Arab nationalism or Arab chauvinism or something like this. But I'm very much convinced, and I argue in my book, that this is just an understanding of revelation as language, as an alternative model to understand revelation through the way it has already been received within communities. When I talk about Ashafi's novel understanding of language, it is that for Ashafi, the prime metaphor is the metaphor of the Qibla, mm-hmm. of the direction of prayer, mm-hmm. And that there is one direction to which you're meant to pray. And similarly, each question of the law has one correct answer. Very often we might not be able to establish the answer with 100% certainty, but at the end of the day, there is still one thing that God intends us to do. The structure of the law is we try to discover the law. So it is not a process of constructing the law. It is not a process of, and that is something that that comes up in the critique of Medinan practice, that Medinans kind of acknowledge that their rules change or have changed historically, and both the Hanafis and Shafi then critique the Medina and say, so clearly at some point your practice must have been wrong. If you keep, changing your positions, then your practice is clearly not some sort of the unchanging, authentic preservation of prophetic practice, but it changes itself. And if you can't justify it, or then you are basically just justifying everything as your local practice, but it's your own opinions, it's your own subjective opinions. And so I think part of the shift towards legal theory that we see with the Shafi'i writing the first work on legal theory is a kind of scientificization of legal thought, a way of saying that you have to actually justify it. It is not enough to you having a big name. It is not enough to this, being dominant in your region, but you have to actually show us what your evidence is and show us how you put this evidence together and why that is the right way of putting it together. And as I try to show in the later chapters of my book, that this approach to law also affected other fields of thought. It affected hadith, it affected tafsir, it affected theology and literature, etc. And in a sense, it can. I mean, and that's another thing that surprised me. These people clearly had read a Shafi'i, and they were clearly in conversation with him. So his thought is not simply a milestone in legal thought, but his theorization of revelation in general affected people's thought about how religious topics and fields work, but not just religious topics, because he's talking about language in general, how language works, how what the connection is between meaning and form. So it even affected people like Jahed.
Now, one of the major strengths of this book is the way that it seamlessly connects intellectual and social history. Not only do you conduct a very multi-layered and close reading and analysis of religious and legal texts, but you put those texts in conversation with the larger social and political conditions operative at the time of Shafi'i's writing. And you specifically target the question of why did this project succeed in the way that it did? Why did it achieve the kind of success that it did? So let me pose that question that you answer in your book. What were some of the major political and social factors and conditions that made his thought so appealing and successful at that moment and beyond? And you've already touched on parts of it when you talked about the conversion of non-Arabs into Islam, etc. But there are other factors also, right?
I mean, maybe to digress a little bit for the beginning of this answer, I had to, in developing this project, I had to struggle a lot with skepticism towards these early sources. Mm-hmm. This is less visible in this book. I've written, it was more visible in my dissertation. I've published a separate article on this. On the authenticity of these early sources. Part of my interest in writing this book is to show how rich a picture it is possible to paint with the available sources and with the available, bringing these different sources into conversation with each other. And what surprises me is how much of this information can be verified. I mean, for example, there's this one thing that really struck me is that the governor of Egypt, Ahmed ibn Tulun, governor in the late third century of the Hijra, who's a big supporter of the Shafi'is. You find an anecdote to say that he brought a Shafi'i student, Rabia, into his house to teach his children and to members of his household. And you find this anecdote and you think, is this true? Is this not true? And then you find lots and lots of information that corroborates it. And you find information that in very different works that members of Ahmed ibn Tulun's household go to Iraq and teach Shafi'i's works there. So if you bring these pieces of information together, I think it is possible to corroborate a lot of quite detailed information and paint a quite detailed image of what was happening, not just in Shafi'i's lifetime, but in the lifetime of Shafi'i's students as well. And my book ends with the death of Shafi'i's last student, who died 66 years after Shafi'i died. Apart from wider social developments, the kind of breakdown of these close-knit conquest societies, there is also patterns of patronage, and especially patronage and persecution. The Shafi'is suffered a lot under the Mihna. Mm-hmm. And what surprised me in looking at the historical source of the Mihna is how much of it was actually had a lot to do with the legal positions rather than with theological positions. So the judge who is really responsible for the harshness of the Mihna in Egypt was a dedicated Hanafi jurist who took the opportunity to basically exterminate the Shafi'i and Maliki school in Egypt. And then afterwards, you have the rise of the Tulunids, the Tulunid dynasty, who are a dynasty that tries to establish itself kind of semi-independently or fully independently. And they are adopting the Shafi'is as kind of a via media between the Hanafis, who are by that time very closely associated to the Abbasid Iraqi political center, and also different from the Malikis, who are very much associated with the old elites in Egypt. So here legal schools become a kind of identity marker and a part and parcel of the political history of the time. But I think what my discussion about politics and patronage show is also that there was relatively limited scope, while the patronage of the Tulunids meant that Shafi'i's works were taught on a large scale, openly. Many of the transmissions, Egypt became a center of teaching Shafi'ism. A lot of his works were taught at that time. Political power was also relatively limited in affecting the intellectual currents, i.e., even under time of religious persecution, these intellectual trends were not, in fact, exterminated, and they survived. So, while I show that there's a significance of politics, there's also limits to the political analysis. As a social history, I think there is issues of personality. They're very different. You know, if you want to be a successful scholar, you need to have good students who continue your legacy, who are not breaking off and developing their own system. And I think here I go into my specific understanding what a madhab is, what a legal school is. I'm wrestling in this book also with the question of you know, at what point do you have a school? We have a lot of discussions about this previously, and I think I'm convinced that you have the emergence of legal schools as soon as the student of the founder start to write books that are in a way secondary sources to us, that are somehow serving the works of the founder, i.e. that either elucidate parts of it, or that abridge it, or that comment it, that initiate a commentary tradition. You can see that took place in Egypt, and it actually didn't quite took place among Shafi'i students in Iraq. He also had students in Iraq, but it's really the Egyptian students who who started engaging in their own literary ventures that were focused on serving a Shafi'i's literature, mm-hmm. and that therefore created this school literature.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit more about Shafi'i students that occupy much of the latter half of your book. Firstly, who are the major students that you focus on of a Shafi'i, and how did they go about transmitting and also reconfiguring a Shafi'i's discourse? And you also make a very interesting point about how the methods of hadith transmission impacted and informed the transmission of a Shafi'i's thoughts. So if you could also talk a bit more about that relationship between hadith transmission and the transmission of a Shafi'i's thought, and the role of his students in the transmission of his discourse.
Yeah, so what struck me so much in writing about in arguing for the authenticity of a Shafi'i's works is how diligent his students were in telling us exactly, what they were doing. And it actually starts already with a Shafi'i in his own works. I mean, he is a stickler. He finds, he has his own notes that he has from when he studied with Malik, for example. And sometimes he finds things in it that he can't quite believe. There's a feminine ending, even though there shouldn't be a feminine ending. Mm-hmm. So he compares his notes with other people who studied with Malik, and he finds that his notes are different from all other people. So at that point, I'm convinced that he made a spelling mistake. He just made a spelling mistake, but he doesn't, he will not do this. He will try to, that's his notes, and according to the hadith method of transmission, he cannot transmit something else, right? He has to transmit his notes. So he is, he's extremely diligent in telling you his doubts, but at the same time, these are his notes, and he just wants to let you know, and he's checked with many other people, and can't possibly be this way. And anyway, so that kind of precision you find among his students, who tell you exactly which part of the work they heard from him, or they might have missed parts of it from him, so they studied with other of his students, and we find this also in the next generation, and so on and so on. So we from very early onwards, you have a whole world of not just within his own text, but also texts that were produced at the same time, and who tell you how they learned about this text, where they studied with them. It's the method of hadith transmission, which is obviously very, very much careful to maintain the authenticity of the text, was also used in transmitting non-hadith texts, even these early legal texts. Mm-hmm. And that is something that that has surprised me, to what extent the extent to which students, Shafi'i students, went in ascertaining the authenticity of specific statement or specific epistle that they transmit. I think taking all these things together, it is remarkably successful and convincing that these texts actually, have survived to a large extent unchanged from that time. So Shafi'i has several main students. The one that I got most acquainted with is Al-Buwaiti, who was the first successor of Shafi'i. And the reason why I was acquainted with him so well is that that's basically the beginning of my project. I discovered his manuscript, his abridgment of Shafi'i's work in my first year in graduate school. And that really was the beginning of me believing that this is an interesting topic, because if one starts reading about Islamic law, everybody claims that the early period has been done. Or, everybody focuses on the early period, or, Islamic studies has an obsession with origins. I was 15 minutes into my research in the Dar al-Kutub in Egypt, and I had already found something that nobody knew existed. So that kind of convinced me that this hasn't been studied very much at all, in fact. This was the first student of Shafi'i I got in contact with. Rabi'a, second student, he's the main transmitter of Shafi'i's works. He was the guy who himself didn't actually write anything, but he was the most reliable person to transmit his works. And he was the one who survived the Shafi'i the longest. He survived him by 66 years. And the third student is Al-Muzani, who might have been the most, kind of the best jurist in his own right. He wrote also an abridgment of Shafi'i's work, and that became the basis of all the large commentaries on Shafi'i law that were written particularly in the 5th century, in the 5th Hijri century. But then we have names of over 100 students of the Shafi'i, and some of them, stayed in other, went to other schools. There was one of his main students was a very prominent Maliki student, there's a whole group of students who we can follow after his death. Ahmed ibn Hanbal was a studied with the Shafi'i, and Ahmed's son is quoting from Ahmed ibn Hanbal's handwritten copy of a Shafi'i's work. So clearly, I mean, this was a serious student. So there's many people who studied with the Shafi'i, whether it's in Iraq or in Egypt, but you only have the development of a relatively small core who actually carry this thought forward. But what is interesting is that different students carry his thoughts forward differently, and that's interesting that we have people with different who see his influence differently, who see the importance of his work differently. Is it primarily about his work on hadith? So his first student, Al-Buwaiti, was much more interested in hadith, while Al-Muzani was less interested in hadith. He was more interested in analogical reasoning and extending a Shafi'i's idea further that way. So there's as it's to be understood, different interpretations of this founder from the very first generation that we encounter. But what they have in common is that they distinguish between a Shafi'i, the scholar, and a Shafi'i's method. So they can disagree with him on individual points, but they adopt his overall project. So they might kind of overrule individual opinions that he has by means of his own thought. So they actually render his ideas more consistent within themselves. So I think that is also an important step on the way towards a legal school, to say that this is I reject his work, or I totally accept it 100% and I just follow every one of his opinions, but rather to say that, well, okay, according to his own methodological rules that he sets out, I correct this one opinion here, this one detail here, or this one detail there. So that is a new kind of legal engagement with somebody's work. And I think that characterizes a legal school, that you have a, what I call a kind of paradigmatic legal school. And I'm kind of taking that a little bit from kind of philosophy of science, that science takes place within scientific paradigms. So you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time. But you rather take, whatever, you take Newton's physics and then you work within the system of Newton's physics. These schools that called themselves by a founder were schools that developed this kind of paradigm of what this founder's approach is, and then, worked from there rather than each jurist kind of starting from scratch.
So, Ahmed, as we are approaching the end of our time here, let me ask you, what are you working on these days, and what can we expect to read from you in the coming future?
Well, I mean, it might at first glance seem strangely unconnected to this book, but my next book is going to be on the changes that took place in Islamic thought with the coming of print in the late 19th, early 20th century. So I'm looking primarily at the role of editors in choosing from this vast pool of manuscripts and deciding which texts were worthy of editing, and how they basically constructed and developed our view of what the kind of the Islamic the classics of Islamic thought are. The reason why this actually isn't that far away from my first project is I'm looking again at a moment of transition. In the first book, I looked primarily on the transition from the oral to the written. Now I'm looking from the on the transition of manuscript culture to print culture. Mm-hmm. But it's also something about these editors who basically in Western scholarship are almost unknown. They have affected our view of what the tradition is in an enormous way. But they have also brought about quite a dramatic change within the Islamic discourse regarding what the tradition is. So a lot of these early texts that we read on the 9th century, 10th century, 11th century were almost forgotten or unknown in the early 20th century. And it was a relatively small group of editors who brought these texts back into circulation, even though there was only one or two copies left in the world. So I want to show this is quite an important shift within even Muslim understandings of what their own intellectual tradition is. And it also has, I think, an interesting angle on the topic of Orientalism, because of course Orientalist scholars were also in that process of editing texts, and there is very interesting interactions going on between these editors and Orientalist scholars, both positive and negative and critical. And I think there is some critiques of Orientalism that I found from the 1920s or 30s that are I think more sophisticated than what Edward Said wrote, half a century later. But it's in terms of time, it's pretty far removed. In terms of place, it still focuses mainly on Egypt. But of course, there are a lot of these are networks of scholars that go all the way, to Morocco in the west, to Europe in the north, and all the way to India in the east.
The Canonization of Islamic Law, a Social and Intellectual History by Ahmad Shamsi, Assistant Professor of Islamic Studies at the University of Chicago, published by Cambridge University Press in 2013. For anyone interested in religion, Islam, Islamic law, or a model of a masterful social and intellectual history, this book really is a must-read. Thank you so much, Ahmad, for your time. It was a pleasure talking to you, and it was wonderful reading your book.
Thank you very much, Ali.
Thank you very much. So this was my conversation with Professor Ahmad Shamsi about his new book, The Canonization of Islamic Law, a Social and Intellectual History, published by Cambridge University Press in 2013. I hope you enjoyed our conversation. Please also join us next time for another episode in New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, stay well and stay tuned. Goodbye for now.